1 Corinthians 10:14 through 11:1. The 28th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians was presented by Ron Julian on August 31, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My argument has been that chapters 8, 9, and 10 of 1 Corinthians all are part of the same unit. They represent the same question that Paul is responding to. As it happens, today is also the end of our looking at 1 Corinthians at all for a while. Next week, David will start a series. Are you going to be in Genesis, David? Okay. Yeah. So that starts next week. So today we're going to finish up the section in Corinthians that we're in. Let me read the final verses of the section, starting from chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, verse 14. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. You judge what I say. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he, are we? All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. Now eat anything that is sold in the meat market, without asking questions, for conscience' sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you, and you wish to go, eat anything that is set before you, without asking questions, for conscience' sake. But if anyone should say to you, this is meat sacrificed to idols, do not eat it, for the sake of the one who informed you, and for conscience' sake. I mean, not your own conscience, but the other man's, for why is my freedom judged by another conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I slandered concerning that for which I give thanks? Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. And you'll notice I've taken the first verse of the next chapter. I think it kind of ends up this section. Okay. So in this conclusion, we find Paul finishing up two themes that he has been exploring. And it's important that we understand that there are both of these themes here. We're going to see both of them very strongly in what he says here. The question has been, is it okay for us to eat meat sacrificed to idols? And one of the issues that Paul has addressed is the way that we exercise our freedom. Are we free to eat this meat sacrificed to idols? Yes, in theory we are. But in practice, the question is, what is the impact of my behavior on other people? And so one of the issues that he has been exploring is the way that the Corinthians, in their sophistication, or in their knowledge that there is no idol and that it's okay to eat this meat, they have been putting pressure on immature believers to join them in this and in essence to violate their conscience, to do what they believe to be wrong so that they can be in with this group that feels very free to eat this meat. So one of the issues has been, are you thinking about the impact of your actions on other people? Are you becoming a stumbling block to other people, inciting them to do what in essence amounts to disobedience to God, even though you're right in thinking that there's nothing wrong with it? You're right in thinking that there's nothing wrong with it, but they do think something's wrong with it. And if you put pressure on them to join you, you're pressuring them to do that which they believe to be wrong. That's one of the issues, and we've talked about that quite a bit as we've gone along. But notice how he begins this final section of chapters 8 through 10. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. He doesn't say, flee from doing anything which might cause your brother to stumble. He puts it stronger than that. Flee from idolatry. Because there is another theme that Paul has been exploring. And that is that this freedom that the Corinthians want to exercise is based in a cavalier, casual attitude towards idolatry itself. They know that there is no idol, and so there's really nothing to the idolatry, but it's not just that. There's a certain casualness about the fact that idolatry is involved with this. In other words, it's not just that they want to eat the meat, but they kind of enjoy, for whatever reason, and we'll explore that a little bit, the dabbling in the idolatrous material. There's something about this. It's not just an exercise of their freedom, but they are verging on actually participating in idolatry itself in the way they're conducting themselves. So not only is the issue, be careful of the impact of your own behavior on others as you exercise your freedom, but also make sure that this freedom that you think that you're exploring isn't in fact just an excuse for indulging yourself in things that you shouldn't be doing. Both of those, I think, are themes in this section, and it's that second point that comes out more strongly as we start out here. Paul is clearly concerned that there is more than just the issue of freedom involved here. So let's see if we can explore a little bit what he might be getting at. He says, I speak as to wise men. You judge what I say. I think there is more than a hint of sarcasm in this language. Paul clearly does not think that the people that he is writing to are particularly wise or particularly mature in the faith. But they themselves see themselves as wise and mature people in the faith. They're justifying their eating the meat sacrificed to idols based on, look, we have knowledge. We know. These other guys are naive and ignorant. They don't understand that we have this freedom to eat this meat. But we have more maturity and wisdom. We understand that we have the right to eat it. So Paul's saying, okay, great. I'm speaking as to wise men. You're wise and discerning? Great. So you figure it out. Doesn't this make sense, what I'm about to say? You wise guys here, doesn't this make sense? Isn't this, in fact, wisdom? And so there's a certain... I don't think when he says, I speak as to wise men, he's not complimenting them. He's not saying, I really trust your discernment and judgment, and so I'm going to give this argument knowing that it will make sense to you. He's saying, if you guys are as wise as you think, say you are, then doesn't this make sense? Isn't this the way we ought to think about this? Okay. So then he goes on to make his argument. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the body of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing? Did I say body? Let me read it again. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? Okay. There are some important ideas we want to explore here. This word sharing is key. This is the word koinonia, which often gets translated as fellowship. If you see the word fellowship in your translation in various places in the New Testament, this is the same word. So, is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in, a fellowship in the blood of Christ? The idea of this word is the idea that I am sharing in the sense that I am joining in partaking with the rest of the group. If I have a fellowship with a certain group, that means I belong. I am participating in the life of that group. Whatever benefits come to being in that group come to me. We can see it in the English word fellowship, which in our evangelical vernacular has kind of come to mean going to meetings with, I'm having fellowship with someone, meaning, you know, I'm going to a potluck with them, or I'm hanging around with them, or something like that. But the English word, like when we say my fellow believer, it's a person who is a believer with me. Together we are fellow believers. Or if you think about at a college, we talk about someone having a fellowship, meaning I belong there. I have a fellowship in this college. I am a member of it. I am one of the faculty of that college. That's the idea that's associated with this word. So the picture that Paul is painting here is that in the Lord's Supper, where we share the cup and we share the bread, it is a picture of us participating together in the life that Christ gives. We belong to Him. We together belong to Him. We're a part of this. There are those who belong to Christ, and there are those who do not. And when we are doing the Lord's Supper, part of what the symbolism of it represents is that we who are doing this together see ourselves as a part of this group. We belong to Him and not otherwise. There are those who would say, no, I don't belong to Christ. I'm not interested in Him. We are not with them. We are with each other in looking to His life, His sacrifice on our behalf. That's the kind of thing that Paul is getting at here. And we don't want to be afraid of this idea. In our culture, we've kind of gotten down on the idea of being elitist, as seeing yourself as being in a particular group. Being in my group is better than not being in my group. And there are, it's true, a lot of things in life where that is an ugly attitude to take. But in fact, as believers, it is an appropriate thing that we celebrate. That in fact, we are those who have been sought out by God for life. We're in this together. I have a share. I have a part in this. You have a part in this. And when we celebrate the Lord's Supper, one of the things that we're saying is, we are doing this because I am looking to Christ's death. You are looking to Christ's death. We are all looking to share in being His people and finding life. Now notice, Paul mentions two religious meals here. He mentions the Lord's Supper, a ceremony where Christians as a group commemorate the body and blood of Christ, sacrificed to give them life, and then eating at the temple. This is the Jewish temple, where you would go and make a sacrifice and offer meat, and part of that meat was burned, part of it was eaten by the priests, but there was part of it that was eaten by the community. You would go, part of the temple procedure was that you would eat part of the animals that had been sacrificed there. They would be cooked and you would participate in a meal. Very similar to what was happening also in the pagan temples, where they would serve the meat after it had been offered there. So Paul is referring to two religious ceremonies that involve eating. And he's saying in both of them, when they participate in this, aren't the people who participate in this saying, we share in this thing? We are a part of this. When we take the Lord's Supper together, we say, we together are in this group that belong to Christ. When the Jews ate the meal at the temple, it wasn't just a meal. It wasn't just, we're going to go to the temple, sacrifice, and then afterwards we're going to go to McDonald's. If they had gone to McDonald's afterwards, it would not have been the same as eating the meat at the temple, even if they ended up eating the same kind of meat at the temple as they ate at McDonald's. Because you're eating it there at the temple, this is the meat that was sacrificed, this was offered to God on the altar, and now we who have made these sacrifices are eating it, we're sharing, we're partakers of this event, this thing that is happening at the altar. We are those who have come to God looking for these sacrifices to be effective on our behalf. And we're sharing in this by eating the meal together. So I think what Paul is getting at here is that these religious kinds of meals are intended not just to be about eating and not just to be about God or religious stuff of some sort, but it is about us together participating in this. I want to be, when I take the Lord's Supper, in part I am saying, I want to be with you. You're taking it, I'm taking it, I want to be a part of God's people. If I'm not interested in being a part of God's people, then there's no reason for me to eat this, because the eating of it is all about being a part. Okay, now, I'm convinced that when you put the whole picture together, Paul is not saying that there is some property in the food that if you eat it, it makes you a part of God's people. There are lots of people who have eaten the Lord's Supper who in their hearts had no real intent to find life with God or submit themselves to God. And there's no magical power in the food that makes them right with God or anything like that. But the meal is all about koinonia. It is about partaking. When we eat from the one bread, it is a picture of how I am looking to Jesus' death on the cross for life. You are looking for that life. You are looking for that life. Together, we are in this group who are looking for that life. So Paul is reminding them that these sorts of religious meals are intended to say something. They are intended to be a picture of turning away from one group and joining myself to another group. I have joined myself to Christ, which is a choice. You can't be in every group. You have to ultimately decide, who do I want to be with? And in the Lord's Supper and in the sacrifices on the altar, there you see the Jews and now Christians having a meal that says, I want to be a part of this thing. Okay? Now, Paul goes on. He said this because he wants to make a point about idolatry. What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Okay, so several things I want to say here to make this clear. First of all, the strength of what he's saying here makes me wonder whether the issue is not merely the meat that they're getting from the meat market, but whether it doesn't involve some of them, as I've said before, going back to the temples. They're not going and sacrificing at the temples, but they're going to the pagan temples, to the dining rooms there, and participating in the communal meals. I don't know that that's the case. Maybe that's not the case. But when he talks here about what he doesn't want them to do, it may be that their knowledge that there is no idol has taken them so far as to say, I might as well join the rest of my community at that dining room, and I can sit there knowing that there's nothing to this meat. It's possible that it has gone that far. But whether it has or not, what we need to reconcile in this section, I don't know if you can feel the tension in what Paul's saying, because he seems to be pulling in two directions at the same time. In the first place, he clearly is not saying you Corinthians were wrong about whether it's okay to eat this meat. It's not. True, there are no idols but there are real demons, so this meat is tainted. This is demon meat, and you had better not eat it because you don't want to be sharers in demons. You'd better not eat this meat because there's demons out there and you might get tainted demonically if you eat this demon meat. That's clearly not what he's saying, because his whole point here, he's going to end by saying, don't even ask about the meat, just eat it. It's just meat. It all belongs to God. So he's not saying that there's some magical power that the demons have put in the meat that makes it so we shouldn't eat it, because he could never say, go ahead and eat it, if that's his concern. So, and yet, he is concerned about something. There's something that he doesn't want them to do, and there's something that he is warning them against. In order to understand what he's concerned about here, I think, there's a couple of ideas that we need to explore. First of all, let's revisit the idea of idolatry. What are we talking about here? What might he be concerned about? As we look back in the history of Israel, they went in to Canaan, a land where there were a whole series of other deities that you might encounter. You go into a city, they were to go in and conquer, but the people they were conquering worshipped other gods other than Yahweh. And what tended to happen to Israel is that they didn't ever explicitly renounce Yahweh, but they would hedge their bets. Here we are with a community of people who are worshiping Baal or whoever, and we don't want to make anybody unhappy here. Certainly the people around us think that Baal is a good guy to keep happy, and yeah, we should probably do that as well. So they would make that decision to try to be Jewish worshipers of Yahweh while sort of expanding the boundaries and making room for the religious practices of the people around them. And this is the choice that God was constantly confronting Israel with. You can't do that. To choose to add something to me is to choose against me, is what God was saying to them. I have nothing but competitors out there. There is no one that I will take on as a partner. I will not take on Baal as a partner. If you're interested in keeping Baal happy, then you have decided that you don't want to keep me happy. Because ultimately you have to decide, who are the powers in this world? And God is saying, there's only one. I am the creator of all. I am the one that you have to deal with. In the end, if you were to keep Baal happy, that's not going to get you anywhere. Because ultimately you're going to stand before me. I am the one that you have to deal with, no one else. Nothing in this world can protect you. Nothing in this world can give you life. Only I can do that. So you might as well deal with me, because there's no one else to deal with. Idolatry for the nation of Israel was to say, well, yeah, there's you, but then we might have some other things too. In this world, it is so easy for us to conclude that there are other things that we have to deal with. And if I'm living in another religious culture, it's easy for me to decide, well, everybody around me seems to think this is going on. I guess I'd better try to keep the peace and go with that as well. God is making a very strong, exclusive claim. You can have me alone, rejecting the idea that any other power in this world can ultimately do anything for you, or you can try to hedge your bets, in which case you have chosen against me. Well, Jack asked a great question several weeks ago. What are the Corinthians attracted to here? What about the idolatry in Corinth could be calling them back? What is Paul concerned about? And I'm not sure. One possibility, the one that strikes me as being perhaps the most likely, is that they enjoyed the approval of the influential pagan community around them. We already know earlier in the book that there's a group in Corinth that is very concerned about appearing to be wise and sophisticated in the eyes of their community. and they don't like the exclusive Jesus is the only way sort of approach that Paul takes. It's embarrassing. He's like a rube, like a hick. He's not impressive to the people around us. We want somebody who's impressive. So it's possible that in their sophistication and saying, hey, we can eat this meat sacrificed to idols, that there's a certain attraction to being the sort of person that is free to go back to the temple, and sure, I know that there's nothing to this idol stuff, but I can be there with the rest of my community, and I can be eating this meat here in the dining room, and there's something kind of nice about being seen as not being one of those hung-up Christians who wouldn't go anywhere near a place like this. That is one possibility for what it is that's attracting them, why it is that they're so insistent on their freedom to eat this meat. So I don't know that that's the case. We can't know ultimately at this point what exactly they were thinking. But that makes sense to me given what we see about the Corinthians. So they're downplaying the exclusive claim of Jesus and of God on their life in order to find acceptance in the community. That's one possibility. And there is a second possibility that maybe, in fact, they still have a somewhat superstitious attachment to the idols themselves. Maybe they have never, like Israel, really made peace with this exclusive claim of God. Maybe they, in some sense, think it would be nice to keep the idols happy. Now, that's a little strange because their theological stance is there are no idols. But that's not necessarily surprising that someone could say my explicit theology is there are no idols and yet emotionally be attached to them and think that there's still something to be gained from them. Whatever it is, for whatever reason, Paul is concerned that some of these Corinthians who are insisting on their right to eat this meat are in fact letting themselves drift over into idolatry itself. That is, I think, bottom line, what at least is involved is they are blurring over that dividing line between either you're with God and Jesus or you're not. That exclusive claim somehow that by in pushing the idea of their freedom, they don't mind blurring that distinction and downplaying the exclusive claim that God has on their life. So like I say, ultimately it's hard to know exactly what the situation was in Corinth, what attracted them there. I've proposed a couple of alternatives, but clearly, at least, they have ceased to recognize the obligation that they have to devote their life to God, to have all of their choices ultimately reflect their commitment to God, the idea that there is no power except God in the world. There is no source of life except God. So, another key idea here to understand what Paul is concerned about in what he just said to them is what we were just talking about, this idea of the religious meal as a ceremony that represents my fellowship in, my sharing in what everyone else here is sharing in as we're eating. So it's clear that Paul is not concerned that the meat is demon meat and it's going to taint me, because he goes on to say, you can go ahead and eat it. That's not a problem. The meat is not a problem. But what is a problem then is the idea that I would participate in these meals that are dedicated to the idea of another power but God. Ultimately, if I'm going to involve myself in religious meals, there are only basically two supernatural power sources that I can be interested in out there. There is the Creator God, the one who made everything, the one who is above all else, the one who sent Jesus, the one with whom I must be reconciled, and so on. Or else, if I'm involved in some other kind of religious practice, appealing to some other powers out there, then ultimately there's only other one supernatural power group out there to be dealing with, and that's the powers of evil, the demons. The pagans are ignorant of what it is they're doing, But if they're not sacrificing to God, then they must ultimately be sacrificing to other powers besides God. And that would be the demons. But I think that the important emphasis, notice what he says, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. Paul is saying, I don't want you to associate yourself with a religious meal that is sacrificing to something other than God. How can you think that that's a trivial thing? So, as I would put together what Paul's concerned with here, it's not the meat itself. He's agreeing with them. Go to the meat market. Eat, as we're going to see down below. Somebody invites you over to dinner. Just eat the meat. Don't worry about it. Because it's not that you're going to partake, you're going to eat demonic forces or something if you eat this meat. That's not his concern. If it was, he would never say, go ahead and eat it. What he's concerned with is that I would knowingly and deliberately associate myself with something that is saying, I belong to this group, when in fact, I should not belong to this group. As he says, you can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons both. You can't go on Sunday, I think it was Sunday probably, when the Corinthians would get together, have the Lord's Supper together at their communal meal. They would get together and have a meal together, and they would have the cup and the bread there as a part of that. You can't do that and then go to the temple later in the week and eat at the dining room in a meal that is dedicated to the idea that we here together are together in sacrificing to and worshiping to this idol. You can't have it both ways. Even if you have this theological idea that there is no idol, what are you doing participating in something that sends the message, I am a part of something other than God? And that's what Paul is concerned about here, that they are so blasé about the difference between worshiping God and worshiping the idols that it doesn't bother them that they would participate in two kinds of religious meals, one that was all about following Jesus and another that was very much not about following Jesus. That's what he's concerned about. That they have gone so far into perhaps a desire to fit into the community or be seen as hip and sophisticated or something, that they are actually sending out the message that they are a part of something that they ought to have nothing to do with. I think that's, as I can see it right now, that's the only thing that I can see that Paul would be getting at. He's not saying that because there are demons, the meat is going to somehow demonize me. But he is saying, I have to decide, what community am I going to have fellowship with in my eating? And you can't have both. You can't have fellowship with both communities. Ultimately, you're going to have to decide, where do you want to belong? He goes on, or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he, are we? This language is very much inspired by the Old Testament. Jealousy is the word that the Old Testament uses to describe God's insistence that his people worship him alone. I am jealous, God says, for you as my people, meaning I don't want you going and worshiping Baal as well as worshiping me. It's like a husband wanting his wife to be faithful to him alone. A husband is not satisfied with the answer, but I come home to you too. Sure, I'm sleeping around with these other guys, but I haven't left you, have I? The husband has a right to be jealous that his wife would keep herself for him alone. And that's the analogy that God uses constantly with Israel, that he is a jealous husband. And Israel is being adulterous and unfaithful in its going out and including other gods in its worship. Well, this language specifically Moses uses in his song, what we call the Song of Moses, where he talks about what Israel had done, their faithlessness, and how God responded. There is, in one place, he talks about how they provoked God to jealousy. And this is the language that Paul is using here. Are we provoking the Lord to jealousy? Are you, in fact, in what you're doing here, actually putting yourself in the same sort of place that Israel was? That you are putting something else alongside God. You're trying to have it both ways. To be a Christian on Sunday and yet involve yourself in the pagan community and communicate that you are still somehow a part of that the rest of the week. Do you think that's going to work? Is God ultimately going to put up with that? Do you think that you are stronger than He is? Do you think somehow that you can prevail against Him? That you can toy with Him? That you can trivialize Him and in the end you're not going to pay? I think that's the kind of thing that Paul is getting at here. He's reminding them that when he says flee from idolatry, that this was the same issue that the Israelites faced. You have to decide, is God God or is there something else going on? Okay, so now, at this point, Paul makes a transition to where he's going to finish up back on the theme that he started with, this idea of think about the impact of your actions on other people. Now we're not so much on the issue of am I going to be idolatrous, but what am I communicating to my fellow believers if I exercise my freedom in such a way that I make them think that somehow it's okay to do something that they know is wrong. He says, all things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. Okay, Paul used this language before when he was talking to them about the way they used their sexuality. But now he's using it again. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. It's pretty easy to see the relevance of this language in this situation. Yes, it is lawful to eat the meat sacrificed to idols. It's okay. It is legal to do it. But is it profitable? Is it worth doing? Does it edify? And then, let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. The question is not whether it's okay for me to do it. The question is, am I having a bad impact on somebody else in my doing it? And we have talked about this quite a bit over the weeks here, so I'm not going to go into great detail about it again. But he's wrapping up this theme. It's not enough to be able to say the rules allow it. Because the question is, what is the actual impact of what I'm doing? Eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience' sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you wish to go, eat anything that is set before you without asking questions for conscience' sake. But if anyone should say to you, this meat is sacrificed to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who informed you and for conscience' sake. Okay, so we have a series of statements about what you should let your conscience, your understanding of what is appropriate and not appropriate, lead you to do. So at the meat market, just buy the meat. Don't worry about it. The earth is the Lord's. That meat doesn't belong to any idol or any demon or anything like that. The meat is God's. He gave the meat. You can gratefully enjoy it. It will keep you alive. It's good. It's meat. Don't worry about it. If someone invites you over to dinner, one of the pagans, one of the Gentiles, they put meat before you. You have dinner with them. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter whether it was meat sacrificed to idols or not, because the meat itself is not the issue. And Paul is saying, I agree with you all that, or those of you who say we have the freedom to eat it. You're right. We have the freedom to eat it. Go ahead. Eat it. It's not a problem. But when does it become a problem? It becomes a problem when I become aware of what I am communicating through doing it. I am becoming aware that I am communicating something that I don't want to communicate. And that would be in the situation if someone invites me over and then they make it explicit, this is meat sacrificed to idols. And I think along with this has to be some idea that they see They're putting it in front of me, and they see some significance in this. You know, you're joining me. In essence, it's kind of like I would see you as joining me in partaking, participating in the life of the pagan community here by eating this meat. So if the person is saying in this situation, does your Christianity keep you from joining me in idolatrous worship? Then the answer must be yes. The idea is not, I have to make sure that I don't do anything that anyone might ever misinterpret in any way. That is impossible to live that way. He's talking about an explicit situation where the person has made it clear to me they are going to interpret my eating as somehow joining them in this thing that I wouldn't think there's anything wrong with. There's one thing to say, I feel free to eat the meat, but it's another thing to say, I feel free to involve myself with other worship practices besides the worship of God. If they've made it clear that that's how they're going to understand my actions, then I have to make it clear that no, I can't go there. So it's all about, what do they understand me to be saying? That's why I think it's important for us to not get too rigid in how we understand this. There are times when it is appropriate for us to communicate to someone, we as Christians have freedom. What I want to look out for, though, is that I'm communicating to someone, I don't care about what's right. I don't care about keeping myself faithful to God. That's what I do not want to communicate. Now, Paul goes on to make it clear when he says, for conscience sake, let's be very clear here. I mean not your own conscience, but the other man's. For why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I slandered concerning that for which I give thanks? Paul's saying here, in my own mind, in my own conscience, my own understanding of what I can and cannot do, I am perfectly free to eat the meat. And that hasn't changed. The fact that the other person sees this meat in a different light doesn't change how I see it. I know what it is. I know that it's just meat. So in accord with my own conscience, on the question of, am I free to eat this meat? You can't dictate to me. Just because you think differently about the question doesn't dictate to my conscience what is right. Paul's saying, I still know, in my own understanding, I know that that freedom is there. If I'm choosing not to do it, it's not because somehow you're dictating to me what's right and wrong. I continue to know and understand what's right and wrong. I'm concerned that I'm not miscommunicating to you in this situation. My concern is that I not communicate to you that I take idolatry to see it as a trivial matter or something like that. That's my concern. But in my own heart, I still have that freedom, and I will go on to exercise that freedom when it is appropriate. So it's not that I am at the tyranny of everyone else's conscience, but rather I have willingly taken on the burden of trying to be helpful and edifying to the people around me. I have taken on the positive burden of, I want to help you understand what's true. I have not taken on the negative burden of letting you tell me what to do. I know that I have the freedom to eat. But I care about you, Paul is saying, that I ought to care about you. And so I am going to choose not to exercise my freedom out of seeking a greater good. But I think it's very interesting that Paul stops and makes this qualification. Don't get the idea somehow that other people are setting the agenda for you. No, you know the agenda. If you choose to submit to their views in this, it is because you have men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. Okay, now I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. This is very much a repetition of what he said earlier. But we can see here, the sophisticated Corinthians congratulate themselves on being theologically hip. They know that there's no idol, and they like that sense of freedom, that sense of, hey, I can kind of do this, it's okay. But their actions are not being done to the glory of God. That is, they are not acknowledging the priority of God in everything. The goodness of God, the rights of God as my creator, the power of God. As they push immature believers to violate their consciences, they show how little they're really concerned with God's values. As they dabble in idolatry, they're showing how little the exclusive claims on their life of God really mean to them. I mean, it's that sense that they are trivializing God in the way they are pushing their freedom. What's more important, the God of the universe or my freedom to do what I want? Every aspect of my life should reflect my belief that God is above all. God alone is good. God alone is the source of life. God alone is trustworthy enough for me to invest my life in. Paul says that's how he lives his life, and in particular, he is pursuing God's values, God's agenda for the salvation of the human race by playing down his own rights when it can contribute to others seeing more clearly the gospel. And again, we talked about this a lot before. I won't go into the details of it. But his emphasis is, he reminds them, when I'm with Jews, I limit my freedoms in such a way that the Jews will not misunderstand me as an evildoer. When I'm with the Gentiles, now I feel the freedom to not live as a Jew. When I am with believers, like these immature believers who think that it is wrong to eat the idol meat, then I don't eat the idol meat. Because again, my concern is I do not want to miscommunicate to them. I do not want to tell them it doesn't matter whether you follow God. Paul says this is how he lives out his life, and he's urging them to do the same. I think when he says he is an imitator of Christ, he's specifically talking about how Christ himself, as he said earlier, did not serve himself, but he served us. Paul, as an apostle, seeks not to serve himself, but to serve those that he is a minister to. And our calling in life, ultimately, is to recognize that if I'm going to follow God, then I have to recognize that God is as concerned about you all as he is about me. And I have to think about the impact of my actions on other people. Okay, so we come to the end of this section. Let me make a couple of brief comments. First of all, his admonition here to flee idolatry. This is very relevant to us, even though we may not have any pagan idolatrous practices around us that we have to avoid. Maybe we do. I mean, there are some of that around us. But, you know, that's not, in our culture, it's not hard for a Christian to stay away from that stuff. I mean, most Christians I know are not particularly attracted to going off and doing, you know, New Age incense stuff and that kind of thing. I mean, we're too scared that we're being involved with idolatry to do anything like that. But the key idea of idolatry is that idea that somewhere out there, there is a competitor to God. Somewhere out there, there is something that I need to make sure I take care of just as much as I take care of my relationship with God. There is no other power. There is no other person. There is no other thing in all of reality that I need to deal with more than I need to deal with God. If I am following God, there becomes room then for me to enjoy what he has created, to be a creature in this world, to participate in the things of this world and enjoy them. But I have to put first things first. I have to get right with God. I have to find out, what does my Creator want from me? Because there is no other important question, ultimately, than that. So we may not be so inclined to go out and worship at the New Age church or something like that, but we live in a world that is filled with competitors to God, with things that say, in my experience, you have to take care of me. You have to make sure that I'm being dealt with. And in that sense, all of us, I think, have to flee idolatry. God will not brook any competitors. The second thing that comes out in the section that I just wanted to emphasize is this idea of fellowship, the idea of belonging to a community. There is something very important about that. Jesus said that he was calling a people together. Paul constantly reminds us that we are Christ's body. It's as if Christ is the head and we are the parts of his body. We are together in this thing. There is a group of people that God is calling together to inherit life. And the fact that I am a part of that group is significant. Or that I am not a part of that group is equally significant. The fact that the Lord's Supper would symbolize that I am a part of that group is a significant thing. Not so much the practice itself, but that when we do that, we are not just saying, I want to be saved by the blood of Christ. It is interesting. Paul understands what we do when we do the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is not a ceremony that was set up to be individual. I don't go into my prayer closet with a piece of bread and some wine and take it and say, I individually am looking for salvation. Not that I am not individually looking for salvation, I am. But the ceremony says, I am looking for that salvation, and you are looking for that salvation. We together are looking for that salvation and are expecting to find ultimately life together by being a part of this thing that God is doing. I think that's a very important idea for us to understand, that we are being called into a group. Not this group. It's not that it's real important that you join this group, because this is just one of a series of group of people throughout history, throughout the world, who are gathering together to try to understand better what it means to follow Jesus and to live that life out together. It's not this group that you're a part of, although you are also a part of this group, and that's meaningful as well. But what Paul's concerned with is, ultimately, there is this group of people in the world. It started thousands of years ago, and that group has been added to bit by bit. I want to be a part of that. I want to share in it. I want to have my part of the inheritance. When the will is read, I want my name to be one of those names on there that is one of the beneficiaries of this salvation that God is bringing about. And then let me just end by reminding us, we've been talking about it all along, but let me just finish up by reminding us about this stumbling block thing that Paul has been talking about from the beginning. Let me reemphasize. Paul is not concerned that I never do anything that offends anybody, because sometimes you have to offend people in doing what is right. He offended people on a regular basis and defended his doing so. But the idea is that I am looking for the welfare of the other person. If I do something that brings someone up short, that they find offensive and, whoa, wait a minute, what was that all about? Hopefully I am doing it because I think in this situation, this is what is needed. When Paul said, no, I will not let you circumcise Titus, even though the Judaizers were offended by the fact that Titus was a Gentile, that he was exercising this freedom not to live as a Jew, Paul said, no, Titus, don't do it. Don't give in. You guys, we're not going there. And he caused a real dissension and a real problem. But I would argue that he did it because he thought that was for everyone's best interest. It was going to serve no one by communicating that the gospel was something other than what it is. You do not need to keep the law to be saved, and so we're not going to give in on that point and miscommunicate that you do need to keep the law to be saved. But in other situations, if someone believes in their naivete and immaturity that a particular practice is wrong, and I put pressure on them to join me in it, now I am miscommunicating. I am saying something very different. I am implying to them, it doesn't matter whether you follow God. It doesn't matter whether you obey Him. And that's something very different, and that would be to their detriment, and I don't want to do that. So the issue that Paul is confronting us with here, basically, it's just living out the implications of the command to love my neighbor as myself. What is in the interests of the people around me? When they need to hear the shocking truth about the gospel, I shock them by the way I live. When they need to understand that righteousness means something to me and it ought to mean something to them, then I don't shock them so that I don't miscommunicate that I think that it's okay to do what is wrong. Is it always easy to tell the difference? No. Will I make mistakes sometimes? Yes. But those are the principles that ought to guide us as we explore this stuff. Okay, so we've come to the end of chapters 8 through 10 of 1 Corinthians. We have just a minute or so if you have any questions or comments about anything.
Okay, hi Ron. I'm thinking, okay, now we talk about, you know, we're talking about this passage in that this is not what you do if you want to be Christian. So then I think, okay, now I got to be back into that memory of what it is that you do want to do if you want to be Christian. And so what, you know, if Paul were to say, now, if you guys want to really get it right, you know, this is what Jesus taught. You know, what kind of passage would he send them to?
Okay. I don't know that there's one passage necessarily that he would send them to.
Or any.
Yeah, I think what's at the heart of this is there is a proclamation that Jesus is the Messiah and that he died on the cross and rose again to demonstrate that he is the Messiah and so that we might be saved from our sins. So at the heart of this is not a thing to do so much as a way of looking at the world, which then is going to determine the sorts of things that I do. So the way of looking at the world is, God is my creator. I'm guilty before him. I stand condemned unless I find mercy. Jesus has come to bring the mercy of God. I accept the message about Jesus because I know that I need that mercy. I know that God is good and I ought to be like him, but I am not. So I need his mercy and I need his help to become what I cannot make myself. That's at the heart of this story, is the problem that God is really there, but I am an offender against his righteousness, and that he is prepared to be merciful and restorative, to bring me back to what I ought to be. So that's what the story of Jesus is about. And then I confront in various ways the implications of that story. In Paul, as we've been going along in 1 Corinthians, he's addressing these various issues, and they're specific issues that look like they're very different, but in a way they all keep coming back to the same thing. The Corinthians are concerned because Paul isn't impressive to the pagan community around them. He doesn't have what they would call wisdom in his style. Well, what's Paul concerned about? That they have taken a different set of priorities and values than ought to be theirs as believers. What does it matter whether the world around me thinks that I'm wise in being a Christian? That can't be, because it's two different ways of looking at the world. So what he's basically telling them is, this Christianity that you say you believe, that God is there, that I am a sinner, that I need mercy, that Jesus provides that mercy, that he restores me ultimately into the kingdom of God and what life ought to be about. That's what I believe. The world around me does not believe that. So of course they're not going to see me as wise. What does it matter? What do you care? They're dying. You have the opportunity to live. So then specifically it works out, so then you shouldn't be joining up into cliques and saying, oh, I like this teacher over this teacher, because you're setting the wrong values here. You're more concerned about who's impressive and sophisticated looking, and you've forgotten the issue is, what are they saying? What is this message really about? So there's an example of how it's the basic way of looking at things, that I, in my will and in my heart, have bowed. God is there. I am responsible before him. I will answer to him ultimately. I will stand before him and be judged. How is that going to turn out? Well, it depends on whether he's merciful. And what's going to determine whether he's merciful? Whether I have acknowledged my need for that mercy and bowed before him and said, be merciful. And then when I hear the story about Jesus, then I say, ah, that makes sense. That's what I need, someone to provide mercy for me. But it all comes down to that basic worldview. We can find dozens of different situations that the apostles address. In this situation, do this. In this situation, do this. But it's not a set of rules they're setting up. It's basically applying the fundamental worldview as a believer to various problems. And believe me, as you go through the Corinthian letters, they have a lot of problems. And most of them come back to the same issue. Fundamentally, many of them are worldly. They take their cues from the world around them, and they have paid little attention to what the gospel actually says about what's true. That's their problem. And that's what Paul's trying to get them to see in this situation, in this situation, in this situation.
Thank you. And I also wanted to say that I guess then the people who don't have that conviction, we just have to pray for those people or let go of them or whatever, because if I have that conviction, I guess God gave it to me.
Yeah. And that oftentimes when we're dealing with other people who are believers or say they believers or people in our family, and maybe we have come to have a little different perspective on what the Christian life looks like from where they're coming from or something like that, it's always a question of time. I mean, as I'm sorting things out, there's always going to be those places where we disagree. But in the end, what we don't want to do is get snooty about, well, you know, I've got the right way to look at it. What we do want to be concerned about, ultimately, is that I myself am trying to live my life in a way that is in keeping with what I understand to be true about God and myself, and be praying and hoping that the people that I'm dealing with are trying to do the same thing. I just try to encourage them to do that. And if they are, the fact that they may not see eye to eye with me on what we have freedom to do or not to do or something like that, that's not so much an issue. The question is, I just want to be a constant influence if I can for making the big deal the big deal. Okay, well, thank you. Next week, David will be starting his series.